Okay, so let's get started here. So today I'm going to talk about multimedia servers. It's going to be a short class. Then I'm going to do a wrap up of the course and I'm going to hand out homework 4, and you also have course evaluations. Okay, so several administrative things to do. The project is also due today, so if you haven't yet submitted it, you can always turn it in electronically. It's not a problem. And I will have Chang grade the project. I don't know how many of you will be around next week to pick up the project. I'm presuming that you are here because the final isn't done. You're not going to do it remotely. But if you are around, I will send out an email. You can just stop by Chang's office or my office to pick it up. Okay, that's the only thing we wouldn't have handed out because it's due today. So take us a few days to grade it. Okay, so let's start a case study on multimedia servers. So this is the last case study we have in this course, and we have talked about some aspects of multimedia, namely audio and video, earlier on in the course. So the objective of today's class is to a little better. Okay, so the objective of today's class is to look at the design of multimedia servers and try to understand what is different about multimedia servers versus other types of storage servers. Okay, so the objective of a multimedia server, also referred to as a media server, okay, is to store and serve requests for multimedia content. Okay, and by this content we primarily mean audio and video, but it could also be large images. Today we are not going to talk about images specifically, but we are going to focus on the first two components, namely audio and video. This is also referred to as continuous media, as we will see. Okay. Now, this type of data, of these types of files, audio and video files, have very different characteristics from traditional text files of various flavors that you are already familiar with. So what we'll try to understand, what are the differences, okay, and why we need different set of techniques to optimize a media server as compared to a normal storage server. So just to clarify what we mean by, you already know what audio file looks like probably if you have listened to course lectures and so on. Now by video file, what we mean is basically a sequence of images that is played out at a constant rate. Okay, any video file basically has a sequence of images, okay, and you play it out at a certain rate. So you can play out 30 images a second. If you want HDTV quality video, that is anywhere between 30 to 60 frames a second or images a second. So you are seeing these images in quick succession and you get the illusion of motion and so on. Okay. Now, not want to. Okay. So the first important thing to keep in mind about audio and video is that these files are almost always compressed. Okay. You don't store this data in raw format because the storage space requirements are very large. So here is an example of a large image and a large video file. So this is a satellite image. These tend to be very large in size. So this satellite image covers 180 square kilometer area with a 30 square meter resolution. So there's one pixel for every 30 square meter in that region. So if you take this raw image, namely uncompressed image, that image is 600 megabytes in size. This is a single image. Okay, and satellites will produce tens of these images every minute. Okay. So that's a large file. And now if you look at NTSC quality video, this is the video, this is broadcast TV or what you get out of your VCRs. Okay, this is lower quality than DVD video. Okay, so this goes at 30 frames a second, that's 30 images every second in the whole file, depends on how long the file is, you have that many images. Each image is 640 by 480 pixels in size. Okay, and each pixel has 3 bytes. Yeah, you have these are color images, so you have byte for R, G, and B, okay, red, blue, and green. So if you have this type of video, then that is 30 megabytes a second, uncompressed. Okay, so if you have several hours worth of video, then you are looking at tens of gigabytes of size. Okay. So these files tend to be very large when they are not compressed. And to reduce the storage space requirement, they are almost always stored in a compressed form. And there are a number of compression algorithms that are used, and we'll talk about one such algorithm, namely MPEG, today. Okay. Now, regardless of the specific compression algorithm, all of them try to achieve a common set of goals. Okay. So they want to reduce the size of this file. How do you go about doing this? What does the compression algorithm do? How does it work? Okay, that's something we need to understand. Okay. Now, most compression algorithms work by trying to eliminate redundancy within the data. Okay. Be it gzip, which is trying to compress a text file, or some image compression algorithm like JPEG, or video compression algorithms like MPEG. They all try to eliminate redundancy in the data and try to store the same information using fewer bits. Okay. This is why you can basically store that same data with smaller storage space requirements. Now, you can ask what kind of redundancy is present within a file. Okay, so let's take images or video in particular. So you will see there are three types of redundancy that any compression algorithm would exploit: spatial redundancy, spectral, and temporal. Okay, spatial redundancy is the correlation between neighboring pixels. Okay, so let's just take an example. So let's suppose this is a single image that you're trying to. Now, a video file would have many of these images. Okay, so just let's look at one. So this is an image. Let's suppose that it's an image of a landscape. Okay, so there may be some mountains, and this is the sky, and there may be a tree here. Okay. So if you look at the composition of this image, you will see that all of these pixels are blue. Okay, this may be some landscape, or rather some field or some such thing. So these pixels are all green. Okay? So what this is telling you is the same pixel or some somewhat similar pixels repeat several times within the image. Okay? And this is referred to as spatial redundancy. This is redundancy in the spatial dimension. So if you have the same pixel that repeats over and over again, you don't have to store each pixel individually, which is what you would do if you stored it in raw format. Right? So if you're raw format, then each of these pixels would be stored as 3 bytes. Okay? Now, if this pixel is blue and the neighboring pixel is blue, you don't have to store the same value again. Okay? The compression algorithm will try to eliminate that redundancy for you. It would store maybe one of these and then put pointers to the rest, okay, saying that this pixel is the same as the neighboring pixel. So you don't have to store the same pixel value twice. You could just use one to get information about the other. This is referred to as spatial, and we'll see exactly how compression algorithm works, but that's the basic thing that it's trying to do. Okay, we'll come back to spectral. Temporal redundancy tries to exploit correlation between successive images. Okay, so this is spatial. This is within space. But as I mentioned, video files have number of these images that you play out every second. Okay, so there is this is time. And these are images. Okay, so if you have NTSC quality, you have 30 images every second. So there are 30 of these. And if you know what video looks like, so each image is going to be only slightly different from the other. Okay, so suppose you have a camcorder and you're recording a scene. Okay, there may be some movement in the scene, but the background is going to remain more or less identical. Or there may be slight differences between successive images. Okay. Now, in a movie, if you have a scene cut, meaning the scene ends and a new scene begins, then the next image will look completely different from the previous one. But then subsequent images are again going to look similar to whatever the first image of that scene looked like. Okay? So if you take that idea, the next frame probably looks similar, and maybe there is a car moving here. Okay, this car may have moved slightly, so it may be at a slightly different location in the next image, but most of the image is similar. Okay? What temporal redundancy tries to do is, if this, when most of these pixels are similar to the one in the previous frame, there is no reason to store all of them again. If this was a raw image, you'd store all of these pixels exactly as they, as you see them again in the file. But if you're trying to compress this prior to storage, then the compression algorithm will look at this frame, try to identify similar pixel block, excuse me, in the previous frame, and then just put pointers. Okay, so you may say that these pixels look exactly like this. So you don't store those pixels. Instead, you say if you want to render these pixels, just go to the previous frame, borrow those, and replace them here. Okay, so you could do things like that. So that's temporal. Now, spectral redundancy is something similar. What all of these compression algorithms do is, prior to compression, they transform this image into what is called the frequency domain. Okay, so this, that exploits or that extracts the frequency signals that are present in the image. Okay, so when you do this transformation, there may be frequencies that look identical across images. Okay, and that is what spectral redundancy is trying to exploit. It is going to say, if this frequency looks similar to that one, there is no reason to store information about each. Separately, you can use one for the other. Okay, is this clear what the basic idea is? Okay. So now let's actually look at one specific compression algorithm that is going to be MPEG. But before we do that, let's try to understand what are we trying to require of this compression algorithm. So the objective is, you want to minimize the complexity of the encoding and the decoding process. Okay? So you want the compression and the decompression algorithms to be as efficient as possible. Okay? This is especially important because you are playing video out in real time. Okay? An important characteristic of audio and video is that during playback, you play data in real time. If you are playing 30 frames a second, you have to have each of these frames available by the time you have to play it out. Otherwise, you are going to get a playback glitch because the data is not available. Okay. Now, if you have this real-time needs, which means you want to play or display, decompress and display every image every 33 milliseconds. That's what 30 frames a second video does. You have to display an image every 33 milliseconds. So within that time period, you not only have to get the data from disk, you also have to decompress it, okay, and render it. So that imposes efficiency requirements on the decompression process. Okay. So and if you are encoding in real time as well, you have similar requirements. Okay. So if you are capturing a video feed and encoding it in real time, you have the same requirement. You have to encode every 33 milliseconds. So you want it to be as efficient as possible, which means you want to minimize the complexity of these algorithms. And then you want to achieve good quality on the decompressed images. Okay, we'll talk about why quality matters or why the quality should even vary in just a moment. And you want the compression rate to be as high as possible. You want the compression algorithm to work well, which means if there is a lot of redundancy, you want it to exploit it so you get good compression ratio, which means the compressed file is significantly smaller. Okay. Now, there are several other general requirements which says that the compression algorithm shouldn't be specific to a frame size or a encoding rate, okay, which means you can throw any video file at it and it should work well. It shouldn't be designed for, let's say, landscape. So if you then feed a movie, okay, then it just starts choking, doesn't work well. So you don't want requirements like that. Okay. You want it to support different data rates. Okay. You want the same compression algorithm to work regardless of whether you are encoding, let's say, DVD quality video versus a small low bitrate video that you want to display over the web. Okay? So it shouldn't be specific to any particular data rate. Okay. Now, we'll talk about two types of compression algorithms. Okay? One is called lossless compression and the other one is lossy compression. Okay? As the name suggests, lossless compression algorithms ensure that when you decompress the data, what you get out of the decompression algorithm is identical to what went into the compression algorithm. Okay, meaning you have some raw data, let's say it's a raw image or raw video, you compress, and then you get a compressed file. And then if you decompress this, and what comes out of this is same as what was fed in. Okay. Now when you compress text files, okay, this is exactly what you expect. If you run gzip or bzip, right? So you compress some file and you decompress it, you get back the original file. There's no question of getting some data that is now lost as a result of this process. Okay. So this is the baseline for any compression algorithm, saying that the reconstructed or the decompressed data is identical to the compressed. Okay. Now, this is good because none of the data is lost, but the drawback is that it can only give you modest level of compression. Okay. The compression rates that these algorithms achieve is not going to be very high because they have a lossless requirement built in. Okay. Now, there's a broad class of algorithms called lossy compression algorithms. And what these algorithms do is that during the compression process, they throw away some information. So when you decompress this data, what you get, okay, looks more or less identical to the original data, but is not exactly identical. Okay? So that is what lossy compression does. So the reconstructed image will have some minor degradation. But if you are careful in what you throw away, there is no visual difference. Okay, if you look at those two images, they will look more or less identical to you. Okay, but they are not really identical. Okay. Now, by allowing these algorithms to throw away information, okay, when you compress, you can get much higher compression rate. Okay. And in particular, these compression algorithms give you a knob which tells you what quality you want to achieve. Okay, if you are interested in high quality, it will throw away less information. If you are interested in high compression rate, it will throw away more information, which means it's going to degrade whatever you decompress. Okay. JPEG, that you probably know JPEG. So JPEG is an algorithm that does lossy compression. Okay. JPEG encoders have all of these options. They tell it what kind of compression you want, okay, high quality or high compression rate, and it can turn this knob. And we'll see what this knob does in just a moment. Okay. But the objective is that it should look virtually lossless. Okay. Although you're throwing away information, okay, you don't want the decompressed data to look very different from the original. Okay. You want it to look as close to the original as possible. Okay. Now in case of images, this may be okay. Okay. In case of text file, lossy compression is a no. You don't want to compress a text file and then when you decompress, some data is gone. Okay. That doesn't work. But for images, it may be fine because what may happen is, so let's say this pixel value is 101. Okay, when you compress it, some of this information is lost, but when you decompress, you basically get 100 instead of 101. That may be a slightly different shade of blue. Okay? It may not be perceptible to the human eye that there is even this difference. Okay, so you may not even realize that some stuff has changed, and that's okay. This is why lossy compression works for images and video, okay, but not for text files. Now, just to give an example here, you can get up to a factor of 5 reduction, but these could give you compression ratios of factors of 200 or higher. Okay, that's a large gain for a small loss in data. So with that background, I'm going to now talk about how MPEG video compression works. Okay. Now, MPEG is a compression standard. It works for both audio and video. Okay, and there are various versions of MPEG that have evolved over time. So what I'm going to talk about is actually MPEG-1. Okay, this is the first version of the standard that was designed, I think, more than 15 years ago. Okay, what this does, so this was designed for NTSC quality video. Okay, this is the same quality that you get out of VHS tapes. Okay, subsequently, you have MPEG-2. Okay, this gives you DVD quality. Okay, any satellite broadcast or if you're a digital cable, okay, that is basically doing MPEG-2. Okay, this is a higher quality than MPEG-1. Basic concept is similar. There are some new features, but this is designed for higher quality video. And there is now also MPEG-4. And MPEG-4 is designed for mobile environment. So if you have mobile TV on your cell phone, for example, okay, all of that uses MPEG-4. So this is designed for small devices. It's more efficient. It can do some stuff that MPEG-2 cannot do. Okay. Now all of these, okay, regardless of which version of MPEG you pick, all of these can both compress audio and video. Okay. So each of these has an algorithm to compress audio and an algorithm to compress video. Okay. What you know as MP3 files, okay, is basically MPEG-1 layer 3. Okay, this is why it's called MP3. Okay. and layer 3 just stands for audio. Okay, so layer 2 is video, layer 3 is audio. Layer 1 just interleaves the two types of data. Okay, if you have a movie that has both audio and video content, layer 1 says store the data in the following format, store some video, then store some audio, store. So it just describes the interleaving. Okay. And then layer 2 does the video compression, layer 3 does the audio compression. Okay. So MP3 is basically MPEG layer 3. Okay. And then so I'm only going to talk about MPEG layer 2, okay, well, how video compression works. Audio compression uses a slightly different set of techniques, which I'm not going to talk about. This just to give you a flavor of what compression is about. Okay. Is that clear? The broad history of MPEG. Okay. So looking at MPEG video compression, which is MPEG 1 layer 2, we'll see that there are two types of encodings that MPEG can perform, what's called intra-frame encoding and inter-frame encoding. Intra-frame encoding tries to exploit spatial redundancy. Yeah, this is trying to exploit redundancy within a single image, like what I've discussed here. Okay. Inter-frame encoding tries to exploit redundancy across images. Okay, so that's doing temporal. The first one is doing spatial. Okay, now I'll talk about those in the next slide. So we'll see something called a transform that this compression algorithm uses. Okay, in particular, the MPEG uses something called a discrete cosine transform. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of what this does, but I'll give you a flavor what this transform does. So the basic idea is to take a raw image, okay, which is just pixel values like this, and first transform it, okay, using in this case using the DCT. And then all of the compression actually happens in the transform domain, as I'll show you in just a moment. Okay. And then there is something called block-based motion compensation, which exploits temporal redundancy. And again, I'll show you what this means. So let's take it one step at a time. So this is what an MPEG compressed file looks like. So these are images within the file. Okay? And depending on what type of compression is applied to each image, you get three types of compressed image types or frame types. And what's called an I-frame, what's called a P-frame, and what's called a B-frame. Okay? I-frame is what is called intra-coded. Okay? I-frames only exploit spatial redundancy within the image. Whenever you have an iframe, none of the data within that iframe exploits any temporal redundancy from neighboring images. It's only spatially compressed. Okay? P frames and the B frames, okay, as the picture shows, not only do spatial but also do temporal compression. Okay, so in particular, what a P frame can do is it can depend on a previous frame that has already occurred in the file. Okay? What a B frame, so this is, you're basically, it's called also predictive coded frames. So any of the pixels here can be predicted based on the pixels you see in one of the previous frames. So you can put a pointer to any of these images. Okay? B frames can depend not only on a previous image, but also an image that occurs later on in the file. Okay? So that is why in a B frame you see pointers going back and forth, meaning this B frame will depend either on this frame or that frame or some combination of the two. But a P frame can only depend on a frame that has already occurred in the file. Okay, yes, question. What happens if a frame depends that you depend on is lost? So if you do that, then you cannot decode this frame. Okay. This is why you will see some occasional glitches if you have digital cable. Okay. You may see some blurred things happening. And that what happens is when during transmission, some of the data in one of these anchor frames, which are called I-frames, gets lost. So if there's any pixels on a subsequent frame that depends there, you cannot decode it. So a patch appears in the image. Not all of the frame will be lost. You'll basically get a patch saying, I cannot decode this. Okay, so this will just look like either black or some arbitrary pixel values. And then as frames go by, then again you can reconstruct. So that will go away. Okay, but if the entire frame is lost, then a lot of the data in a subsequent frame may be lost. Okay? Alright. So one question is, why should we have a frame depend on a frame later on, an image later on in the file, as well as an image that has occurred earlier in the file? Why not just have the pointers go backward? Yes.
Maybe like a video, you might have some panning, so maybe you have a whole scene later on, which I don't want
Right.
Yes,
exactly. So you may have things like panning, which is where the camera is moving. Okay. So some new, as the camera moves, new parts of the environment appear in the image that haven't appeared in the previous frame. So those blocks will not be present in the previous block. Okay, but they will, since you're panning, once they've appeared in view, they'll continue to stay in view in subsequent frames. So you can have those pixels be predicted from a future frame. Okay, or there may be some change in the scene. So for example, somebody walks in the door. Okay, any image of the door before this point will not have this person in that image. But once the person has walked through the door, he will be present, he or she would be present in a subsequent frame. Okay. So if you want to predict all of the pixels of the person's face or the body, okay, you have to make it depend on subsequent frames, not previous frames. Okay. So this is why you have bidirectional prediction in B frames. Okay. And because you do bidirectional prediction, you also get the highest temporal compression. Okay, because there's a greater chance that any pixel block in a B frame is present in a previous frame or a subsequent frame. Okay? P frames are only predicted, meaning you only predict backwards, you don't look at future frames. Okay? And I frames don't depend on any other frame. I frames are also called anchor frame. They're only spatially encoded. There is no temporal compression being exploited. So they are the least compression ratios. Okay? Now you may ask the question, why do we need iframe. Let's make the first frame an iframe, then let all of the frames depend on some frame or the other. Okay, that will give you better compression. So why do you need an iframe at all? Okay, why do you need several iframes in the image? So to understand that, let me first give a little bit of background and then we'll come back to this. So what is shown there is basically what is called a group of pictures. Okay, this is a set of images that depend on one another. Okay, so there's a pattern that you see in that, which is basically the GOP or the group of pictures looks like I, B, B, two or three Bs, P, B, B, and then there's an I. Okay, this is a repeating pattern. Okay, if you look at subsequent images within that file, the same pattern is going to repeat. After this I, there will be three Bs and a P and a three Bs and an I and so on. So every 10th frame or 9th frame or so is an I frame in this recurring pattern. Okay. So question is, why should we have these I frames at all? Why not just go B, B, B and so on? Yeah, so why do we even need P frames for that matter?
After a long time, the image may be falsified. So you need an I frame to reconstruct.
So one point being raised is, after a long period of time, none of the pixels within that image may be present in a previous frame. Okay? So to understand this, what I forgot to mention is P frames can only depend on an I frames, and B frames can only depend on a P or an I. Okay? Meaning a B frame cannot depend on another B frame. So the arrows go this way. So this can only depend on this. Meaning when you try to do temporal encoding, the dependency of any pixels here can only depend on pixels here, not on these. And these can only depend this way. You cannot have arrow going from B to B, for example. Yes?
Is it randomly decided that whether you should put a P frame or a B frame based on how much change you are seeing in the
previous? That's a good question. So the question is, is it adaptively determined whether to put a B or a P? Okay, now the standard, if you read the standard carefully, it doesn't tell you that you actually have to have a pattern. You can decide however you want. You can only have I and all the Bs, or you can decide whether you want to dynamically insert a B or a P. Okay, but all of that increases the complexity of the compression process. Because I said that you have to compress in real time. You have to make all of the decisions on the fly. Am I getting good dependency? Am I not? Should I now make this a B frame? This increases compression dependency. Which is why most compression algorithms or encoders allow you to specify a pattern before you encode, and they just stick to it. They just say, this is the way it is going to be. We are not going to change it on the fly. Okay, so this is more of an efficiency reason, but you could choose it dynamic. Okay, now question is, if you have a static pattern, why should we have eyes repeating? Okay, yes. So in case of, if data is lost, okay, there needs to be a point to you resynchronize. If you only have B's, okay, and let's say some there is some I data that is lost, and then you have all of these B depending on this I, then you will never be able to reconstruct them. Okay? I's don't depend on anything else. So if you get this frame, you can decode this without looking at any other frame. Okay, so that's a point of resynchronization. Okay? Also, if in video playback you want to allow, let's say, fast forward or rewind, okay, I's are again the points of resynchronization. Okay? Let's suppose that you are watching a video, right? So you basically move that slider bar that you see and you just move it somewhere. That basically tells the player it has to now start playing the video from this point in the file. Okay? Now, if there are no iframes, they all depend on a previous frame, then you have to decode the whole sequence in order to get to that point. Right? So there is no way to jump there if all the frames depend on some other frames. So in order to resynchronize, you have to find the closest iframe in this case. And start from there, because that doesn't depend on anything. You can decode that independently of other frames. Okay? If there are dependencies going from all frames to many other frames, then you cannot jump to arbitrary points without having to decode all these other things first. Yeah, because if you don't decode them, you cannot decode this one, because there are pointers going from here to here. Okay? So they yield random access. They also yield points of resynchronization in case of failures. Okay, and the last thing is, if you just have only B's, the compression rate eventually is going to fall. Okay? Because let's say 10 minutes into the video, what you are watching on that image may not have anything to do with when the movie began. Okay, so the pixels are not going to be able to reproduce based on what you saw 10 minutes ago. Okay, you will only see this temporal redundancy in a neighboring set of frames, not frames that you saw 10 minutes or 1 hour ago. Okay, so because of all of these reasons, you need to insert these I and P frames in between. Okay? So anyway, so that's what the type of frame looks like. But now let me show you what happens within each frame. Okay? So I haven't talked about what happens in an I, P and a B frame. So let me quickly talk about that and then we'll move on. Okay, so iframe is actually no different from a JPEG encoded frame, because JPEG does exactly that. It only exploits spatial redundancy. Okay, so if you know what iframe does, that's exactly what JPEG compressed images look like. So to compress an iframe, here is what you do. Let's take a raw image. Okay, these are just pixels. Okay, you chop this image into 8x8 pixel blocks. Okay, so within each, there are 8 pixels, or 8x8 pixels. So there are 64 pixels here. Okay, so you do this. And then you apply what is called a discrete cosine transform to each of these pixel blocks. So you take one pixel block at a time and you apply the DCT. Okay? DCT basically is think of it as a matrix multiplication. Okay? These pixels are basically, this is a matrix. Okay? Each pixel value is a number. Okay? That tells you what shade of red, green or blue it is. Okay? So if you basically take this pixel block, that looks like a matrix. It tells you what are the values of the pixels at that location. Okay? The discrete cosine transform is just doing a transform, which is effectively a matrix multiplication, and the transform tells you what matrix to multiply it with. This is the DCT matrix. Okay? When you do this, you will get a new matrix. That's also an 8x8 matrix. Okay? Now the same information as the original raw pixels, but in what is called the frequency domain. Okay. Now, what does that mean? So, if you look at a DCT transformed pixel block, okay, there are these 64 images. Okay. The top left value is called the DC coefficient. Okay. And these are all, the remaining 63 are called AC coefficients. Okay. DC coefficient represents the average color that you've seen within the image. Okay. So, basically, what this shows is what is the average value of all of these pixels. That is the average color within that 8x8 pixel block. Okay? And the AC coefficients represent the variations that you see within that pixel block. Not all of those pixels have to be identical. There may be patterns, or let's say there's a tree here. Okay? So these pixels may be blue and these pixels may be green. There may be texture here within the tree. Okay? All of these variations are captured by this AC coefficients. Okay? And these are now called frequency coefficients. So this is the DC frequency, which is basically the average color value within all of this. Okay? This is basically the average of green and blue, for example. Okay? And these are the AC coefficients. So this is the highest frequency coefficient, and these are the lower frequency coefficients. So more texture you have, or more variations you see within the pixel block, you will see that these higher frequency coefficients will have non-zero values. Okay? And less fluctuations you have, these coefficients tend to be zero or close to zero. Okay? In the ideal case, okay, where let's say all of this is just a blue sky and all of these pixel values are identical, okay, what should that discrete cosine transform give you? Basically, this value should be the average of this, and if they're all identical, this value is basically the same value there, and all of the rest are zeros. Okay, there is no variation in the picture. Okay. So you have represented 64 pixels, as effectively all of this information is captured in a single integer, because all the remaining ones are zero. So in a compressed file, you're not going to store zeros. Okay. So you basically stored 64 integers, as a single integer, which is a DC coefficient, plus a symbol which says the remaining 63 coefficients are zero. So this is what gives you compression. Okay, so you see why the discrete cosine transform has given you compression, because 64 integers are now represented as one. Now, if there is some variation, what will happen is the DC coefficient will be non-zero. Some of the lower frequency coefficients will be non-zero, but the higher frequency coefficients tend to be zero. So what this transform is doing is it's taking information in this pixel block and trying to represent it in as small values as possible. Okay, in particular, if all the coefficients are identical, all the pixels are identical, everything gets represented in one integer. Okay, yes, question there. Is the window size constant? So in this case, the 8x8 pixel block is defined by the standard. You don't change it. The image size can be arbitrary. Okay, what you will do is you will chop the image up into 8x8 pixel blocks and then apply DCT to each pixel block.
So the
block size is a constant specified by the standard. Okay, JPEG does the exact same thing. Yes. Right. So each of these represents an 8x8 block. So you will do the same thing on this block and this block and this block and this block. So you are compressing the image 8x8 pixels at a time. Okay, and there's a reason for that, which I'll talk about in a moment. So this is what gives you compression. Okay, now where does the lossy part come in? If you actually store this and you do the inverse DCT, you are going to get exactly this. Okay, so where the lossy part comes in is how you decide what to store within the DCT. So what is in the top left here is the more important part of the DCT, and what is in the bottom is the less important part. So let's assume you get something like, let's say 64, 32, 10, and then these are all zeros, and there are some scattered ones everywhere. Okay, and then lots of zeros. Okay, which means basically there is more or less uniformity, but there are some small differences once you do the DCT. What MPEG will do is it will take all these small values and turn them to zeros, saying this is high frequency coefficients, not very important, let's turn them to zeros. And now you get a large block of zeros that can all be thrown away, so you don't have to store this information in the file. So it will do this, and as a result of changing some of these low, small coefficients down to zero, you have lost information. So when you decompress it, what you get back will not be identical, because you threw away some of those coefficients thinking they're not important. Okay. But what you get will be roughly identical to what you started with. Okay. Some of the pixel values may change a shade a little bit, but it's not perceptible, you cannot see it. Okay. I mean, you cannot, it's a sort of, not visible to the human eye. Okay? This is why it's lossy compression, because you're throwing away all this information to get as much compression as possible. Okay? Now, the last point is that's what an iframe is. Okay? So the iframe is all these 8x8 pixel blocks converted into DCT, and then you compress it. Okay, what do the B and P frames do? So in a B frame, what you will do is what is called motion compensation. This doesn't work. So let's say this is an I-frame, and this is a P-frame. So here you will again chop up this image into 8x8 pixel blocks. Okay. And for each of this pixel block, you will run a search algorithm within an iframe, saying, is this pixel block present in the iframe? Okay. Now, the search may not be an exact match, okay, because there may be some variation. So, you have to say, is there a similar looking pixel block there? Which means that many of those pixel values are identical, but not all of them are. Okay, if you find an exact match, that's great, because then this information is just a pointer. There is nothing to do. Okay? But you may not get an exact match. You may get some slight variations depending on what has happened and the image mobility and so on. So first you run this search algorithm, which is called motion compensation. Let's assume that you find a match. Okay? And the match can appear anywhere. It doesn't mean that this block is going to match that block. Okay? Because of motion, this block may be represented here. Okay? This is a moving person. The person may have moved, so those pixel values are present in a different location. Okay, so once you do the search and you find this match, what you consider to be a good match, what you do is you take the difference between this and this first. Okay? If this is an identical match, then this becomes all zeros. Yeah, because it's just and then there is nothing to compress here. Yeah, because if it's all zeros, there is nothing to compress. You just say this is all done. Okay, just 1 second. But if there are slight differences, what will happen is this, which is called error between what you have found and what is there, will be some non-zero values. Okay? And this is what you will encode. Okay? Now, this, as you can see, if this is a good match, these pixels are already small in value. Okay? There may be ones, twos, or fives. If this is an 8-bit image, then the pixel values can go from 0 to 255. Okay? But if this is a good match, then the difference between a pixel here and a pixel here may be small. The difference may be 1, 2, 3, or some small value. So this error block is already all small integers. Then you do a DCT on this, and what you will get is some even smaller values where only the DC coefficient becomes a small value, which is the average of those, maybe 5 or so, and then many of these become zeros. Okay? So you got even better compression as a result of doing this. So this is what temporally encoded frames do. You find a match, take the difference between the original block and the matched block, and then you do a DCT on that. Yes, you had a question.
If the block is moved to other place, should a pframe include information which the place
now? Yeah, yeah. So the question is, how do you store this information? There's something called a motion. When you do motion compensation, there is this thing called a motion pointer. A motion pointer basically says to reconstruct this block, okay, it's a pointer saying first go get that block, okay, decompress this block, then get these pixels value and take this and add it back because you took the difference. And if you add it back, then whatever you get is what the block looked like. Okay, so you have effectively a DCT compressed block and a motion pointer. Okay, that pointer basically says to do this, that's the block you're depending on. So there's a pointer there. No, motion pointer is something you do with the search algorithm, right? When you do a search, you find a matching block, then you put a pointer saying this block is going to depend on that block. Okay, so you will basically have encode the location of these pixels in this thing, that this is where the pixels are, and then you take the difference and that's the error and you encode the error, okay, using DCT. Okay, is that clear? Okay. Any other questions here? And the B frame does the same thing, except that you can look in multiple I frame that is ahead of you and I frame behind you. So pointers can go both ways. Okay, motion pointers can go both ways. That's the difference between P and B. Okay. So that is basically basics of MPEG video compression. Okay, three types of frames, 8x8 pixel blocks, use this thing called a discrete cosine transform, which tries to take the information present in the raw pixels, store it in as few coefficients as possible. Okay, and then you throw away the higher frequency coefficient using a technique called quantization, okay, which gives you the lossy part. Okay, depending on how much you throw away, you can get more or less loss. That is the knob that I was talking about. Okay, if you want to get higher compression rate, you are willing to throw away more. Okay, but that means when you decompress, you get more difference between the original and the decompressed. Okay, and if you throw away less, then you basically get better quality but lower compression. And if you don't throw anything away, you get lossless encoded video. Okay? So that is MPEG. So now with that background, we'll talk a little bit about multimedia storage servers, okay, which was the whole point of doing all of this. Okay. So a media server, okay, is a storage server that has a lot of disks that stores audio and video content. Okay. And then it's assumed that requests for this content arrive, and then the storage server has to retrieve this data and send it over. This is not very different from a file server. Okay. In effect, this is a file server, but it's storing audio and video files as opposed to textual files. Okay. So like any network file server that we have seen, you have a client and you have a server, and the server has all of the data, and you send requests and retrieve data. Okay. Except that there are some differences. Okay. The first difference is that a media server has to respect the real-time nature of audio and video files. Okay. We talked about this already. If you have 30 frames a second video, okay, the server has to retrieve 30 frames every second, okay, over a period of time and keep sending this to the client. If you don't, the client is going to see a glitch. Okay? So you have to respect real-time nature of audio and video content. This is not true in a textual file server. When you make an NFS request, it doesn't matter if the data comes back in 10 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds. The server appears slow, but the client application is not going to be impacted. Other than you feel that the system is slow, there is no correctness issue. In a media server, there is a correctness issue. If the data doesn't come, there is a playback freezes, audio and video playback. Okay, so for correct application behavior, you want the server to provide some guarantees on the rate at which is retrieving data. Okay. The other difference is that media servers are optimized for large files and large reads and writes. Okay. Textual file servers, on the file servers that we know about, they are optimized for small files and small files, reads and writes. When we are talking about NFS, I gave you a quick tutorial of the Unix file system, and I was talking about the inode structure, which is optimized for small files and it penalizes larger files. Okay. So that's a fundamental assumption they have made in file server. And here all files are large. Okay, video files tend to be gigabytes or hundreds of gigabytes. Audio files may be tens of megabytes. Okay, so you don't get 4 kilobyte video files. So you have to optimize a system for very large files, okay, and large data rates as well. So there are many techniques that you have to look at in order to design such a file server. And I'm not going to talk about all of them, but let me mention. The first one is placement. Okay, how do you go about storing very large files on disks within the file server? That's the placement problem. Okay. There's fault tolerance problems, because most of the times, the amount of data that you store on these servers is so large that it doesn't fit in a single file or a single disk rather. So you have your server is going to have multiple disks, and it may have a RAID array or some something of that sort, in which case you have to design the system to tolerate disk failures as well. We talked about some of this already. And then there is the notion of how do you retrieve this data and meet real-time requirements of clients and so on. And then can you exploit things like caching and batching and buffering. So what I will do is I'll quickly talk about the placement issue and then maybe say something about the admission control and the storage issue. Okay. So here's a picture of what a single disk looks like. We talked about this already when we did file servers. So a disk, a single disk consists of multiple platters. Each platter looks like a CD. It has concentric tracks where data is stored. Okay. And then there is a disk head, and then this platter is spinning. Okay, within a disk. And this disk head can move back and forth and position itself on any track. Okay, and then it can read and write data to that track. Okay, this is how you record data or read or write data on a magnetic disk. Okay, same thing is true of a CD. Okay, except that in a real hard disk, there are multiple of these platters, not a single one. In a CD, there's only one platter, so you read and write on one surface. But here, there are multiple. We already talked about when you have to retrieve data, you have to first move the head to the right track, which is what's called the seek time. Okay? Then you have to wait until the right sector spins under the disk, okay, because it's spinning. So although you are on the right track, the data may be somewhere else on the track. So you have to wait until the track spins by the disk, which is called a rotational latency. At that point, you can do something useful, which is read or write data. And the whole point is to design placement algorithms so that you minimize seek time and rotational latency, because that's wasted work as far as the disk is concerned. It's not doing anything useful. So you know about disk arrays already. We talked about this when we did ZFS and so on. So in a large storage server of any sort, you have more than one disk. You may have tens, hundreds, or even thousands of disks, in a, depending on the size of the server. Okay, these are often referred to as disk arrays or arrays of disks. So media servers typically would also have a disk array because of the large amounts of storage that is required on the system. Okay. And these, the placement technique that is used is what is called striping, okay, which also we talked about in the context of NFS. Just trying to see if we have a picture here. Yes. So this is an example of a disk array with five disks. And the blue file is a, what is called striped across this array. So what happens here is, rather than storing the file on a single disk, you chop it up into smaller blocks. Can you store these blocks on successive disks in round robin order? Okay. So the first block of the blue file is stored on disk 1, the second one on disk 2, and so on. Okay. Until you go to disk 5, then you cycle back and store it. Okay. And we said there are some advantages of doing this. You get higher parallelism when you're trying to retrieve this data. If you want to retrieve, let's say, 10 kilobytes, that may be three blocks. So then you basically send requests to three disks, which will retrieve this in parallel. Okay? So striping gives you higher throughput. And this is important for media servers because they are storing content at a very high data rates. Okay? Megabytes a second would have to be retrieved if you have to serve high content video. Okay, so this is this is what striping is about. So let me go back here. So the key thing, key parameter when you use striping is what is called a stripe unit size, or also called the block size. Okay, what's the block size that you would use when you do the striping? When you break this file up into smaller block, what's the chunk size to use? Okay. Now, typical file systems use block sizes of 1 kilobyte, 4 kilobytes, some use 8 kilobytes. Okay. Media servers use block sizes of megabytes, not kilobytes, so several orders of magnitude higher. And the only reason for to do this is to increase throughput. Okay, because I said every time you have to retrieve some content, you have to pay a seek and a rotational latency. You already know that you are retrieving large amounts of data. So why not make the block size larger? So you have one seek and then you get an entire megabyte, for example. Okay, then you don't pay this overhead for lots of little blocks. Okay. So that's one difference between media servers and a normal file system. The stripe units are also called the block size is high. Now, degree of striping just says how many disks do you have in the array. That tells you the amount of parallelism you're going to get. And you try to increase this as much as possible as well. Okay, so you get high parallelism and high data rates. Okay. Now, the second important difference between normal file systems and media servers is that typical file systems use a client pull architecture. Media servers use server push, which I had also mentioned earlier. So in the normal file system, to access a file, you send a request to the server and you get the data. That's what's called client pull. In this case, what you do is you say, I want to play this movie. Okay, the media player on the client is just going to say, play this movie. And the server is then going to retrieve this data periodically and send it to you without any additional requests. You don't say, give me the next 1 megabyte of the file. You don't send requests like that all the time. You just say play, and the data rate is known, so the server knows how much data to retrieve and send to you every second, okay, or every half second, for whatever the however the system is designed. Okay. So client pull architecture is designed mostly for traditional file systems, and here we have what's called a server push architecture. Okay, the way these media servers are designed is what are called periodic rounds. Okay, so they use this notion of rounds. Let me talk about that in just a moment here. Okay, so for simplicity, I'm going to assume just a single disk. Okay, this is your server. So let's assume that the server is retrieving two files, okay, two movies concurrently. These are two independent requests that have come in from two clients. So it has to retrieve data for both of these movies and send them out. So it uses this notion of a round. And what happens in each round is at the beginning of the round. So let's say this is time. At the beginning of the round, it says for each movie that is being played out, what data do I need to retrieve? Okay, so let's suppose the round duration is 1 second. okay, just for simplicity. Let's also assume that the playback rate is 30 frames a second, okay, for this move. So at the beginning of each round, you have to figure out what are the next 30 frames that I need to retrieve. Okay? Then figure out which disk blocks they reside on, and then send requests to those disks. Okay? So at the beginning of each round, you'll send out requests saying retrieve these blocks, okay, read. And then the disk has until the end of this round to get all of that data out. Okay? So the data comes back by the end of the round. It doesn't have to wait until whenever it comes, it's done. And then at the next round, you will say, I'm going to now retrieve the next 30 frames. So you figure out what disk blocks they reside in and again send off request. So for each movie being played at the beginning of the round, you first determine what data you want, okay, for this file, and then send off these requests. And then you wait until the end of the round. Okay. Now, when the data has come back from disk at the beginning of the next round, it is sent over the network to the client. This is a push architecture. There are no explicit requests. The server is itself figuring out what data the client needs at the beginning of each round. It gets it by the end of the round, and it pushes it over the network. And the client is just listening on a socket, and data is continuously arriving. Yes, question there. Question is a good point. So question is, what's the difference between read ahead and this? So read ahead basically is prefetching data for you. Okay, but in a client pull architecture, you still have to wait for an explicit read request before you send the data. In the server push architecture, also you are prefetching in the sort of 1 second ahead, you are prefetching the data from disk. Okay, but then it's just sent out without the client waiting. Okay. And then the second thing is there is a rate associated here. In a read ahead, you don't have a notion of a rate at which the client is reading. Here you know exactly what data is needed, 30 frames a second, so you know exactly what 30 frames to retrieve every second. Right? Then the read ahead, you can decide how much to read ahead or how much not. Here you know precisely how much to read. Yeah, that's the difference. Okay. Is this clear? So there's continuous retrieval happening here of data, and that's being sent out to the client. Yes.
If you're transmitting too fast for a client, then what happens if the client's buffer is full or something like that?
Okay, that's a good question. So question is, what happens if you're transmitting too fast for a client, if the client buffer is filled up and so on. So there are many techniques to handle this. Okay, one is the server can basically get some feedback from the client and slow down. Okay, in which case you may or may not make your real-time guarantees. But more often than not, there is some data that is going to be dropped somewhere. If the client is not able to keep up, something is going to get dropped and data is going to get lost. Okay. For that very reason, it is very important for the client and the server to negotiate what rate to send at before the playback starts so that these problems don't occur. Okay. So this is why if you have a media client, you can specify, am I on a broadband connection or am I on a dial-up connection and so on. So this is the negotiation period, saying this is the network I have, this is the rate at which I can retrieve, and you can choose that based on your buffer size as well. So it's assumed that you do all this beforehand. This is the problem of admission control I'm going to talk about. So once you've figured this out, it's assumed that the client has the necessary resources to actually receive this feed. Okay, yes, question there. The question is, can that be handled dynamically? So it turns out that most practical servers do handle that dynamically because they don't actually provide you any real-time guarantees. And the reason for not that is not the server but the network. If this data is going over the internet makes no guarantees, right? So this data may or may not get to the client in time. Okay? So depending on what congestions you're seeing, what loss you're actually seeing in the network, the client can renegotiate. So if you have Windows Media or RealPlayer or QuickTime, they all have this renegotiation mechanism saying, slow down, I'm seeing a lot of loss. Okay, so then the server may slow down and then you may catch up at a later point. So they have all these built-in algorithms. Okay. But if you have a well-provisioned network where you actually want real-time guarantees, then it's assumed that you have enough bandwidth or you're provisioned enough bandwidth. But that's not the case in the real world because there are no guarantees that the network gives you, even though the server may give you this guarantee. The network is not under your control. Good? Yes.
The server is overloaded. Is there a way of sort of reducing the amount of data?
Right. So server is overloaded. So just hold off on that. I'm going to talk about that in 2 slides. Okay, that's the problem of admission control. Okay. So placement, I already talked about. That's the problem of striping. I said block sizes are large, that hundreds of kilobytes, or at higher data rate, they are megabytes. Okay, so that's the data rate that you store. Okay, so that now let's talk about this admission control. So since these servers have to service these requests with some real-time notions, okay, you have to carefully control the load of the server. Okay, in a media server. This is not true in a traditional file system. If lots of clients try to access the server at the same time, send lot of requests, the server as a whole slows down and everyone sees slower performance. And that's okay. You just assume that the server is loaded, so things are slowing down. In a media server, this is problematic. Okay? If you continuously let new play requests coming in and you start sending new content out, at some point the server is going to be overloaded. It will not be able to retrieve all of the data that's needed. Okay? And so if you have this one round duration, if there are 100 files that you need to that you are servicing, the amount of time it requires you to retrieve all the data for these 100 files may exceed 1 second, which is the duration of the round. Because by the end of that second, you are going to send the next batch of requests out. Okay? So you have to control the load on the server so that all of the data that you retrieve in one round can indeed be retrieved in that round. And this is the problem of admission control, which says that you will limit the number of clients you can service concurrently. Okay? If the load goes above that, you are going to send a request, send a response saying, I cannot service you. Okay? Now, this is not done in a traditional file system. The server doesn't say, I'm heavily loaded, so I'm not going to service your read request. Okay? But media servers do this. And so do web servers. I mean, there you probably have gone to web server, where you got a message, server busy. It's doing exactly that. It says there are too many requests queued up. I'm not going to service your request for now. Media servers do the same thing. If you click on it and it's overloaded, it will either make you wait, which is a nice way of saying I'm not going to play right now. It will just wait for it. It may just say loading actually. So you think that it's loading, but it's waiting for some client, some playback to finish so it can let you in. But or it can say I'm busy, try again later. So it will do this so you can always keep up with the real-time rates. So you will limit the load on the server so you don't get overloaded. Otherwise, you will start violating all these real-time needs. Okay? That's another big difference between traditional file systems and media servers. Okay? That they do not service unlimited number of client requests. They will put a limit to meet these real-time needs. Okay? And what is there on this slide is basically how do you decide how many clients to let in. Okay, so what is effectively done is you estimate how much the new client needs and then you verify if you have sufficient capacity to service that. And that basically says if I have, let's say in each round I have n files I'm retrieving, if a new client comes in and now I retrieve n plus 1 files, can I get all of that data out from disk by the end of the round? Okay, if you make some assumptions, each request takes a certain amount of time. So now n plus 1 client sending all these requests, can I retrieve all these blocks? If I cannot retrieve that by end of the round, I say I cannot admit this client, I'm already at capacity. But if I can, then I say I'm going to let this client in. Okay, that's the basic idea. There are lots of details which I'm going to gloss over here. So you can deny a request if you do not have capacity. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay. So that's all I have for media servers. Before I do a quick wrap up, are there any questions on what I just talked about here? Okay. So I'm not going to do all of this because I have the course evaluations as well. Let me just do a quick wrap up. Yeah, so we have covered a lot of ground. Yeah, this is all the topics we covered here. So we started with communication in distributed systems. We looked at RPCs. We looked at message versus stream-oriented communication. That was the first time we actually talked about video, incidentally. That was very early on in lecture 2. Yeah, some of these concepts were discussed there. Okay, then we looked at processes and scheduling. We looked at process migration, code migration. We looked at this problem of multiprocessor scheduling as well as scheduling tasks in a distributed system. tells us the problem of load balancing. Okay. The idea was you could move processes around to improve load balancing for in the system. Okay, then we did naming, that was very quick, just one lecture, where we looked at DNS, recursive, iterative, name resolution, directory services. Okay, this was all the problem of you have to figure out, you have a name and you want to translate it into something. Maybe it's an IP address, maybe it's user to password. So how do you do that in large system? Okay, here the key point was the naming system itself was distributed rather than a centralized directory or a distributed directory. And DNS is just one example of that. Okay. And then we spent quite a bit of time on these canonical problems, starting from clock synchronization, GPS. We did Lamports and vector clocks, which was a way to do synchronizations without any notion of real time. Okay. So you basically did not synchronize the system with any clock, and yet you could figure out a reason about order of events. Yeah, which is what synchronization allows you to do. And then we looked at several other algorithms, from leader election to mutual exclusion and transactions. Okay, we looked at two-phase locking, strict two-phase locking. Okay, so those, that I, if there's one thing to take away, I would take away those concepts, because those keep arising in lots of different scenarios. Okay, and I consider that to be the more important part of the course. Okay. And then we did consistency and replication. Okay, here we looked at a whole slew of semantics. Okay, what kind of consistency would you provide whenever your replication and one of the replica changes some data? Okay, what do the other replicas do? What do client requests see from the system? That was the broad problem. We looked at a specific instance in the context of web caching. Okay, fault tolerance was again a short topic. So there, we looked at this notion of the Byzantine general problems. What is this notion of Byzantine faults? How can you tolerate these faults? And then in the context of RPCs and other systems, how do you get fault tolerance? Okay. Security is again a topic that I've de-emphasized in recent years, because now there's a separate course on this topic. But we did look at this in some detail. We looked at public key cryptography, symmetric ciphers, and so on. We looked at how you can do authentication, encryption, and then how all of these techniques come together in various applications, from email to electronic payments. Okay, so that is where I think you should try to see how techniques apply in the context of distributed systems. Okay. File systems, we looked at three. Okay. NFS, which is widely used, the canonical distributed file system, but there were these two other interesting ones. Coda, which is designed for mobile environments, okay, where users come and go and you can get disconnected. So there was the problem of how do you handle disconnection in a file system. That was looked at there. XFS was this notion of serverless file systems. Okay, if all machines are powerful, rather than having a distinguished machine called a server, any machine can act as a server and a client. Okay, so that was the basic idea there. Now, how do you design? And that has some parallels to peer-to-peer file systems as well, as we talked about them. Okay. And then there were several of these case studies, starting from distributed middleware. We did Corba, Genie, DCOM. Okay. And then there was sensor networks, today's class on multimedia. Okay. So that's a quick bird's eye view of all of the ground we have covered. As far as the final is concerned, it's cumulative, which means that it will have cover everything from early on. But I will emphasize the later parts of the course, okay, because some of this material we already covered in the midterm. Okay, but be aware that everything is fair game for the final. Okay, so that's, I'm not going to talk about the rest. You can read it. Okay, there are some pieces of advice on how to design systems, which I'm not going to have time to talk about. But I'll just leave all of you with this. There's all various courses that you can think of as follow-on courses which go off in different directions. Okay, there's networking, there's course on multimedia systems, which I haven't taught for a couple of years. There's database systems, security. There's an advanced source course which is also defunct at this point, but may get revived. There's wireless sensor networks. And then I teach this other course on OS programming, where we take Linux kernels and hack it. learn to how to program the kernel. So there are a variety of these courses available. So if this is your area of interest, okay, you can branch off in various directions depending on where exactly you want to go. Okay, so with that, I'm going to stop and let me ask for a volunteer to do the course evaluations.